Welcome to the REF SCAD podcast, where we explore the intersection between faith and creativity. And this month, we're sitting down with Connor Lawless. Connor, glad you're here this morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yep. I guess we'll start. We're hot off the heels of SCAD Film Festival, Savannah Film Festival. I'm curious from your side of things, highlights, what stood out, what were you able to go do and see?
Man, I thought it was absolutely incredible. So many talented people showed up for the festival. So many great films. Sadie Sink did not show up, but that's whatever. I thought it was a really great week. I think there has been a lot of great films. I got to see The Banshees of Inisherin, The Whale, Glass Onion. Tons of great stuff. And then because I'm a dramatic writing major, they offer a lot of pop-up master classes with a lot of the visiting guests. And so basically you get to sit down and have very casual conversations with these working professionals and get to ask questions that you really couldn't get to ask otherwise, which is really great.
Nice. Because I guess the past 2 years it's been affected by COVID? Like, I think 2 years ago, right, it was just all virtual. And then last year, I'm trying to remember, did they have one or was it like a hybrid thing?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, 2020 was entirely virtual. And so, I mean, it was just you went on the website and you would click on the link and you'd watch the movie. There was none of that personal element. 2021, they had a limited film festival.
That's
so
right.
It was really nice to see films in person with people. And they had some good movies that year too, but, I mean, it was all masked. It was all, I mean, it was weird. It was like post pandemic COVID times.
Right.
So,
and like limited people in screenings and things like, I think
yeah.
It was just open to SCAD people.
Yeah. Also. It was not the big event that it usually was.
Right. Yeah.
So in comparison to the past couple of years, this has been the first big one in a long time. And so to experience it firing on all cylinders has been super awesome.
Yeah, nice. So as far as some of the workshops, like did y'all go through stuff you've been working on or did you talk more about their creative process or what was that like?
A bunch of things. So some of the ones that I went to a class with Ron Howard, obviously
from
Apollo 13. He was there with 13 Lives, which have you seen that movie?
Not yet, no.
That is an incredibly tense thriller. It's a true story. It happened in about 2018. This soccer team got stuck in a cave, I believe it was in Thailand. And so it's about the divers that had to save all these kids from this flooded cave system. And
do you remember the event? I didn't remember. So did he direct it or write?
Yeah, he directed it and produced it.
Yeah.
So, this version is an amazing telling of the story too. So I would definitely, it's on Amazon. I would definitely check it out.
Yeah,
but
nice.
So he talked about that for a little bit, but then also just his process directing, talking to actors, department heads, and that was super awesome. Allison Anders, she worked on Paris, Texas, and she's also had her own directing career in film and in television. She talked about producing and also shooting on television budgets, which was super helpful. Elaine McKenna, who... she was great. She's written for films like The Devil Wears Prada, which super fun movie. And so to hear her process on writing and then Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which it was a musical TV show. So to hear about writing songs for like 20 episodes of TV a season, like 1 to 5 songs, super fun and absolutely crazy that they did that. And I guess one last one to mention, Jennifer Caitlin Robinson, who directed Do Revenge for Netflix and then also co-wrote Thor Love and Thunder with Taika Waititi. So to hear her work with Marvel, that whole process and comparatively like how that compares to writing her own stuff was super insightful.
That's really cool. Would you say that those stood out as highlights or did you enjoy going to see some of the stuff that that was premiering?
I would say definitely the classes were the biggest highlight for me, but I mean, it's film fest, so you got to see movies.
That's right.
And
that's right.
So yeah, those are some of the best theatrical film experiences that I've experienced in my life. It is super fun to see a film like Glass Onion in a packed theater. Everybody's in on it. And to hear that kind of uproarious laughter and cheering the entire time, it's definitely an all-time theater experience. Yeah. For
and
sure.
Yeah, unless you've been to a film festival, it's kind of hard to explain, but the culture of them is so much fun. Mm-hmm. It really is. It is so much fun. Because like everybody's there to celebrate this thing that we collectively love, especially when you have theaters like Lucas and Trustees. It's like, mm-hmm. man, I don't know that a film-going experience gets a whole lot better than that. No, so that's really cool.
Yeah, it's absolutely great.
So a good way to start off senior year, I guess. So give us a little bit of the backstory. How did you end up at SCAD?
So in high school, I knew I wanted to do film. Me and my buddies would shoot videos on the weekends. We wouldn't write them per se, but I mean, we just wanted to shoot stuff to shoot stuff, you know? And so I knew from a very young age that I wanted to do film. And so in high school, that's when I finally started filming things on my own. And we did that for a long time. Obviously, like, they weren't great or anything, but it was just like, yeah, it was just getting started. And so I started shooting those, filming those. And then on the side, I started writing other projects too, just to kind of get my foot in the door, because I'd never really done that sort of thing before. And I did that for about maybe since sophomore year. So I did it for the last 3 years of high school and then looked around for film schools. And my older brother recommended SCAD. He went to SCAD for his master's degree. He works as a multimedia specialist now. And so he learned film from SCAD, and I was looking to go to film school, and he recommended it. I looked at it, toured the school, and it just, I fell in love with Savannah and the kind of community that I thought would be here and the kind of environment that the school was in. I really just fell in love with all of it. And so, after looking at like a handful of schools, I applied to SCAD and I got in, and now I'm here.
Yeah. What was the turning point for you from a film standpoint of going from, I enjoy this thing to, I think I might want to do this and maybe even do it as a career?
I think definitely, I guess if you want to talk about enjoyment of film, I was very, very young when I saw Star Wars for the first time. I don't know, if there's going to be an inciting incident on love of film, I mean, it was seeing Star Wars for the first time. I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, and my film language at that point was just VeggieTales. And VeggieTales is good, but, you know, it's VeggieTales, so, I mean, it's pretty limited. And I was rummaging through our VHS cabinet looking for tapes, and I found my dad's DVD special edition original trilogy package for Star Wars. And I was like, what is this thing? What is this? It was a gold silver package. And it was like this crazy looking thing. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. And my dad popped up behind me. He's like, you want to watch? And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And title came on, boom. I was blown away. And it came with a documentary, a Ken Burns documentary called Empire of Dreams. And watching that and seeing how George Lucas came up with the story and seeing all of the talented craftspeople behind the scenes, making the models, doing all the blue screen work, that blew my mind. And so from that moment on, I was like, I want to do this. I want to be involved with this in some way.
So both of these things happen sort of simultaneously, like your enjoyment of film, and also if I love it this much, I need to be on the making side of things too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's cool. What's your take on sort of the Star Wars reboot as of recently?
Oh, geez. Star Wars is an abusive relationship. It is rough. Because it'll give you some great things sometimes. It'll reward you and it'll treat you nicely. And other times it is just like, I never want to go back to it. It is, yeah, lots of mixed emotions. But I would say out of all the things, I think the best things is to come out of the Disney Star Wars reboot. Rogue One, which just an incredibly thrilling story about the rebels getting the Death Star plans, and then Andor, which related to Rogue One, really takes a deep dive into that pre New Hope kind of Empire mm-hmm. era of Star Wars. And so all that stuff has been the most interesting. The actual films themselves, like 7, 8, and 9, have been... They've definitely left me wanting in terms of cohesion. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I thought Rogue One was a little underappreciated. I think what I liked about it was that it didn't feel the pressure to be huge in scope. Mm. It was kind of its own little concise...
It was focused.
It felt so focused. I'm totally with you on that. Okay, good. A little more love for Rogue One. I'll take it. Yeah. All right, so then ended up at SCAD. What was your progression then of like delving even more into film and writing like?
So freshman year, I was set on the film department, the film program, and what I quickly realized was I was not as interested in production as I was in the development side of film. So the film program, obviously, you're making stuff, you're producing a lot of material, and that's great. I think you learn a lot of great things through that program. I just realized that I enjoyed the development, storytelling side of things. And that isn't to say that there isn't an art in production or any of that stuff. That is an art all unto its own. I think I just realized that what excited me about film was in that writing space. And so I switched departments pretty early on, right before COVID hit. I switched over to the dramatic writing department. And I would say that's been super influential on just the way I tell stories and the way I think about film now, the way I watch film now. It's definitely been influential on that whole experience.
What was it about writing, do you think, that really captivated you?
Well, I think it's what captivates anybody. It's the ability to make a complete stranger feel something, to make people empathize with experiences that might be completely outrageous or incomprehensible, but they make you relate to somebody who doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And their power to communicate messages, complex messages, in easily digestible narrative, I think it's astounding.
So as we kind of do this intersection of faith and creativity that we try to get to at the podcast, part of it is taking what really moves and captivates us from a creative standpoint, and also thinking through what that has to say about our own experience of faith and really just the biblical story as a whole. So for you, like when you think of your own story of faith, is there like a pivotal moment for you, or like what was your story getting up, maybe up until SCAD?
So my story of faith, I grew up in a Christian household my entire life. I grew up going to Sunday school. I grew up going to church, and I never thought that much of it. That was just status quo. That was just normal. I didn't devote a lot of time to questioning my faith, or, you know, like Jesus died for your sins, he was born again. And I just accepted, like, yeah, okay. And I never put too much critical thought into it until high school. I went to a small Christian school, and it's just high school, but you're going to, like, you take a Bible class and you go to chapel once a week. And that around that time is when I started to realize, like, all right, what this book is saying, but also everybody that I'm around who professes this thing is not acting in accordance with the book. And that's where that disconnect started to happen. And I grew more and more disenchanted with the whole thing throughout high school and just through all those experiences. And going to SCAD, I initially had no intention of pursuing any of that any further, because I just felt, no, I've been there, I've done that, and I've dealt with like hypocrisy in Christian school and in the church. I like had been involved with youth ministries, and it was not the best time. And so, like, the people I met there were, they didn't exemplify the certain, like, certain values that you would expect, like, of the Christian community. Sure. And so it was definitely, it was difficult to kind of take all that in. And so I was really not aiming to pursue it any further at SCAD, but I went to the club fair Fall Fest, my freshman fall quarter, and I was checking out all the clubs, and I came across all your RUF's table, and Morgan, who was the president at that time, yeah, she just started talking to me, handed me the card with all the information on it, and she basically told me I was going to show up. And
it sounds pretty on brand.
Yeah, yeah. She told me that I was going to show up, and I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. But that was the, I would say that was the first independent choice that I made where, like, I just by myself was like, okay, I'm going to go to this thing, faith related. It's not because my parents are telling me to, or my family's telling me to. I'm going to check this thing out. And I believe it was the first thing I went to was a film club. We watched Searching, and which that was super fun. And then we got to the discussion afterwards, and I realized that it's that stereotype, the Christian stereotype, where it's like, oh no, R-rated movies are bad, and like you can't watch those sort of things. And then, I mean, so Searching isn't rated R, but I mean, there's some intense stuff that happens in that movie. And so to just get into a form where it's like all art, like art is art, and we can engage with it and discuss it and then apply a certain lens to it and see, view it through how faith and creativity intersect, that was like a revelation to me, because I was like, wait, you can do both. Like you don't need to be ignorant about the thing that you want to be in. Like you can actively engage with it while also believing the thing. I thought that was really cool. And so that led to, I went to a large group or midweek now. And, I would say that was the most inclusive, church environment I had been in up to that point. And so to experience that and just be welcomed with open arms was something that was new to me. And it's, that was something I actively started looking for in a church home since then. And so I would say those first few RUF meetings, and that kind of gave me a template of what I wanted to look for in a church home going forward. And then also it kind of opened me back up to seeking a relationship with God.
How do you think, I mean, I don't think it's surprising to anybody if we think about, like, we're in this setting of, you know, Christianity being taught, and there's this disconnect between the way that community operates. I don't think it's surprising to hear when you're suddenly in a context where it seems like there's a little more cohesion, that that feels more welcoming and more of an invitation to invite somebody else into. For you, how did that translate into, like, I really want to further investigate, like, who Jesus is and like the claims of this relating to me now that you were in a community that embodied that? Like what about that helped the light kind of switch on?
Well, I think it was the fact that you had people who, I would say it was the way in which, I mean, it's like what you're saying, people were acting in accordance with the message. And my experience up to that point had been one of, you go to church, everybody's nice at church, you meet somebody on a Tuesday, though it could be totally different, but no, it was, people were consistent in who they were, who they presented themselves as. And to see that, and to see that modeled in the people that were there at the time, and then also in the messages, and like the message, like it wasn't skirting around certain things. It was like, it was tackling real issues that I found interesting. And so I want that. I want to conduct myself in this way, in a consistent way like this. And so I would say it was definitely the people that, like, the way they conducted themselves.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like the common thread in a lot of what you've been talking about is this pushback against things being, like, cheapened. And what I mean by that is even your first interaction in a film club where, you know, with all the appropriate disclaimers of discretion of, like, okay, as, you know, as Christians, we want to make sure that we're not doing things that are going to be against our sanctification. Like, with all of the appropriate disclaimers, like, what we want to do is not be reductionistic in the way we engage with story. Like, we want to do honor to that thing, and the way we do honor to it is actually by, like, recognizing the complexity. So, like, we don't want to cheapen the value of story in film. We also, like, don't want to cheapen the value of the story of Christianity. And it's like by honoring the complexity of stories in film, like, we're actually learning to honor the complexities of the biblical story. You can also apply the same thing to a community. It's like, you know, none of us want to sit here and say that the truthfulness of Christianity lives and dies by, like, the faithfulness of the adherents. But at the same time, like, you walk into a group of people and it's like, they don't really seem to take this that seriously. It does kind of feel like it cheapens, like, if they don't, like, if they don't see more inherent value in this, then, like, why should I? And then suddenly you get into a group of people that, like, do want to take it seriously, and, like, want to live a life responsively that is, like, seeking to honor Jesus. Suddenly it doesn't cheapen it anymore. Like, suddenly it brings to light, like, the real value that is the center of the story is Jesus himself. So, yeah, like, there does feel like there's a common thread with all those things. With story, it's like, for you writing stories, we like try to intersect the way that particular mediums cohere with what the Bible's doing, and story is, like, probably the most obvious one there is. It's like, of all the ways that God could reveal himself, he gives it to us in the form of a story. I'm curious for you how you, like, in your own writing, in your own storytelling, what it looks like for those two things to sort of go hand in hand, like your own understanding and lived out experience of the biblical story, but also the way that translates into your creativity as a writer. Like, how do you see those things relating?
So, over the course of during my time in the dramatic writing career, I've written a handful of short films. I've written a podcast. And right now, I'm working on the second draft of a comedy play that, I've been working on for about the past year. And, we're nearing the end of that. I'm super excited. And also developing a feature film that I'm hoping to have done by the end of March.
So tell us about the play.
So the play is, it is a superhero story that takes place in Casper, Wyoming. It is the world of, like, a Silver Age comic book. So it kind of looks like a Jack Kirby kind of a comic book. And, it's Casper, Wyoming. It's a super small town, and we're dealing with Z-list superheroes and supervillains. And our supervillain realizes that his arch nemesis is depressed. Like, it's the classic setup where we have our villain. He's got the damsel in distress. He's got her at the chemical factory. He's going to blow it up. She's over a vat of chemicals. And our guy's late. He's late. He is super late. And he talks to his henchman. He's like, it's 11:16 PM. He's late. This doesn't make sense. And he's like, I don't know what to tell you. Our hero eventually does show up, but he is drunk out of his mind. He can't walk in a straight line. He's talking in the wrong direction. And for our villain, this is not acceptable. This is not acceptable. He's like, this is unprofessional. I got to get to the bottom of this. What's going on? And he deduces that, Oh, you're not actually dating, like, the damsel in distress? You're not dating the reporter at the paper? It's like, I thought that was the whole thing. I thought that was, like... So he falsely misdiagnoses the source of his depression. And so he tries to set him up with this girl at the paper. But in the process, he realizes that he himself and the hero, they love each other in a way that neither of them expected.
So how did this idea come about?
out of sheer panic. So I took the first playwriting class in the fall of last year, and over the summer I was like, yeah, I'm gonna write this play. It's gonna be like, I did theater in high school. It's like, I'm gonna write about that. I'm gonna make a play about doing a play. And I worked on that for a while, and we had our pitch. I remember it was like a Wednesday night, and I had to pitch Thursday afternoon, and it's midnight Wednesday, the day before I pitch, and I'm looking at my material, and I'm like, this sucks. This is so bad.
It's a great feeling.
It's the best. And so I threw everything out that I'd worked on over the whole summer and started fresh. And just started writing like a maniac in my notebook and trying to figure out what interests me. I'm not going to think about, you know, I think I was thinking too much about it's a playwriting professor. What would they be into? And that was dumb for a couple of reasons. It's dumb because it's not something I was genuinely interested in. And also I knew nothing about theater. So it's like, I was making very narrow false assumptions about my audience. And so it's like, all right, no, okay, let me just write something for me. And so I stayed up till 4 a.m, just jotting stuff down. And then I decided on like superhero, supervillain, love story. And I was like, oh, that could be fun. And thinking about the ways to execute that, and like what are some things that we haven't seen? Like, I mean, we haven't seen one, I think, like in a town like Casper, Wyoming, like this very small town, Z-list, and taking influences from like the Adam West Batman or films like The Great Race, just super campy, fun, vibrant, and my knowledge of theater is still limited. I know a little more now, but I'm pretty sure superheroes are not typically theater fare. They did a Spider-Man play back in the 2000s, and it was abysmal. So
it's ripe for redemption.
Yes. So I was like, all right, yeah, I'll try that.
There's something about self-imposed limitations, although I guess this wasn't self-imposed, but limitations that sometimes, I don't know what it is or how this happens, but when a limitation is right in front of you, sometimes that just like explodes the creativity. I don't know if it's desperation or what, but clearly something is going on when there's a limitation.
Deadlines are super helpful.
Oh yeah. Any kind of limitation. I mean, deadlines especially too.
Yeah.
That really though is super impressive to have the objectivity to just throw something out the day before. It like totally goes totally in line with the whole sunk cost fallacy. It's like, okay, I've worked on this for months, but it's just not that good, so why keep going? So what stage are you on? So you're in the middle of a rewrite. How much more do you anticipate? Like, what can we expect with it in the future?
Yeah, so I'm working on the second draft right now. I'd say I'm about 85% done. I think I have maybe two more scenes to write, and then it'll be done. At the time of recording this, I have a full reading due tonight in a couple hours. So it's going to be complete by the time this comes out.
We can editor's note at the end to update everybody on whether or not it was actually completed.
Yes. I would love for everybody to know I didn't make it. Working on the second draft, it's all about just getting more laughs. It's been about kind of deepening the characters. First draft was fun, but it was a little broad strokey. So getting more specific, getting a lot more of those details on their backstories, making sure it's more thematically coherent, kind of tightening all those loose ends. So what we can expect in the future. I'm taking another class in the winter where we're going to be refining it a little bit more, and then we're going to be rehearsing a staged reading with actors for a few weeks. And so I think maybe around April or May, students should be able to see a blocked staged version of the show. Very limited. I mean, I'm calling for a lot of expensive stuff. I'm calling for explosions and projections and a bunch of things.
If you're going to do it right.
Oh, yeah. It's right now, I'm just writing it like it's somebody else's problem, knowing full well that it's going to be my problem in like a couple months. But yeah, hopefully there is a like some sort of version with costumes that people can watch by the end of the school year.
That's awesome. All right, so here is what is compelling or interesting or confusing about this to me with comedy and rewrites. When I think about recording music, for example, I kind of know the thing that I'm after, and I keep redoing and redoing, and it's like you can kind of recognize when it gets there with some degree of objectivity. With comedy, it kind of feels way more subjective, like if something is or isn't funny. And if you've looked at it 200 times, like it's not going to be funny, right? Like you've looked at it enough times, like the joke's up. How do you know when you're rewriting if it's funnier or not? Like, is there a way to even tell? You just have to shop it? Like, how does that even work?
Yeah, it's difficult because, I mean, that was another thing at Film Fest. I mean, you hear a bunch of different writers talk about their processes. And so some people need a room and they're bouncing ideas off of each other. And some people sit alone in the dark by themselves. And I fall into that latter camp. And so I'm basically in my room late at night or at Coffee Roasters in the back corner, very quiet, trying to make myself laugh. Like, I don't know if this is actually funny, but I think it's kind of messed up. I think it's funny.
The idea of you sitting in the back of Coffee Roaster just by yourself kind of giggling intently is really delightful.
The amount of I'm so glad nobody's seen me do that. Well, nobody that I know yet. It happens a lot more than you think.
I believe that, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a process of, for me, like in terms of developing, I have to be alone in a quiet space to just get into that zone of like within the scene, what's it? Because I mean, you can do jokes, but also you have to, it's not really going to work unless it comes from a genuine human emotional place where you need to know exactly what people's motivations are going into the scene, what they want, what their weaknesses are. And then just making them hurt in the funniest way possible. And so you have to know your characters and you have to know the scene super well. And so mining all of those for laughs, that has to be done in isolation. And then, ultimately you don't know really if it's funny until you put it in front of people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of two things is going to happen. Either it's going to bomb horribly and you're going to feel all the air sucked out of the room as people read these punchlines and nothing happens. Oof. And you're just sitting in front of the classroom thinking, oh, I'm so stupid. Or it really connects with people and you get the feedback that you want. And so there is a way to kind of know whether or not it's going to connect, but it all boils down to like if you know who your character is, what their motivation is, and like is the joke coming from a genuine place, and it's not just, oh, that's a funny line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can actually make sense of that because what I started to learn, like the creative people that I have gleaned the most from, you know, some people sort of they work on stuff and then they can start to sort of see it kind of comes together sort of unbeknownst to them. But the ones that I gravitate towards are the ones that have such a focus on the vision that when you lose the objectivity, what you can do is say, like, I have enough confidence in the idea, even if I can't really tell in the moment because I've lost objectivity. It's like, I believe in this idea enough to keep going towards that. And even with comedy, like what you're saying is, yeah, maybe I don't know the line itself, but like I did enough work on these characters and knowing who they are and their motivations that if this feels like an extension of who they are and I believe in this idea enough, like I've got to just trust that that's going to work. I can wrap my head around that. I can't do that, but I can wrap my head around that. Tell us about the feature. You mentioned the feature you're working on.
So that one... less funny. I think that one's going to be more of a drama, but I would like to tap into more of my younger experience in the church, dealing with a lot of the hypocrisy and you hear the term like cultural Christianity, like in the South a lot. So I would like to talk more about those things in the next project. It's still very early on. I'm kind of developing the exact storyline and what exactly the theme. I'm still articulating what exactly that needs to be right now. But that's definitely like the subject material that I'm interested mm-hmm. in right now, like tackling those.
Yeah, what's compelling about that to me is normally when you have these types of critiques, it's coming from the outside looking in. In other words, typically it's by people who are being critical of whatever it is, but in this case, Christianity as a non-Christian, maybe advocating people away from it. But what's compelling about this is it's somebody who's actually advocating for Christianity, and it's doing it in a way that has a genuine love for Jesus and his church, mm-hmm. and saying, like, if we really do love Jesus and his church, like, we ought to love the things that Jesus loves, mm-hmm. and we ought to sort of strive for consistency, recognizing, you know, we're not going to do it perfectly. So it's really compelling to hear of somebody doing that from a place of love rather than, like, dismissal, which probably means, like, your willingness, like we're talking about earlier, to not be simplistic or reductionistic or to cheapen is going to be a lot heightened. That's compelling to me.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot, like, I love the play, but I think this, I mean, obviously this next project is a lot more complex than, you know, the play. I mean, one, it's not superheroes. It's a lot less fictional. So, I mean, I've just been doing a lot more research on it, and that's been really engaging. I coming from a place of love, you know, it's like I would like to say I'm a man of the faith, and that I believe in Jesus, and I want to just express that people have been hurt by the church, but it's not because of God. It's because of other people. Mm-hmm. And it's because of this inconsistency and this hypocrisy that unfortunately does pop up frequently in the church. And so to talk about that in a place where you can communicate the idea that, yes, you like not negating the pain or any of that stuff, because that genuinely hurts and you shouldn't ignore that or push it under the rug, but to come with from an place of understanding and to say, like, I understand. And
In some ways that's John chapter 2, right? I mean, it's Jesus going into the temple and seeing the hypocrisy of those who are supposed to be the biggest advocates for true faith, and they've done the opposite. And it's the instance where we see Jesus the most angry and the most upset really of his entire ministry. And I suspect it's because he knows the type of damage that hypocrisy does to others, but also he knows how, like, that type of hypocrisy actually, it's like it's an affront to the very character of God. And Jesus is doing it because he's glorifying God, like he's elevating himself. For somebody within the church to be able to nuance that and to express that, I think we actually need more of it. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful. So senior year, wrapping up, sort of getting there, RUF president. If you kind of look at your time here, what is some things you would have wanted, or I guess that you would want, like, younger students to know about their time, either in SCAD, in RUF, in Savannah? What wisdom as president would you want to impart?
Oh, man.
As our collective club leader.
Okay. Yeah, no pressure.
State of the Union.
Oh no. I didn't know we did a state of... Oh.
That's what this should have been. Oh. The State of the Union.
Now I'm scared. I think you just have to put yourself out there. You really have to jump on opportunities as they come up. SCAD is an awesome place. It's also a very hectic place, and opportunities are going to come and go in the blink of an eye, and you have to trust in your ability and trust in God's guidance. And if he gives you a feeling that an opportunity might lead to something, just jump on it. You have to really embrace I mean, it feels like a train that's just already moving. So you just have to jump on.
Yeah, that's fair.
On the right car. And so you just have to take things as they come and go. And another thing I would say is you have to be secure in who you are. And I mean, that's a lot easier to do or not do. Oh, my goodness. It's a lot easier to say than do. But just knowing who you are yourself and with God, it'll help you do all those things, those things like networking, those things that seem so scary. Because I mean, if you know who you are, then, and you know your relationship with God, you're going to be stronger in those instances where it might seem like other people's opinions of you can be paralyzing. Mm-hmm. And so having that security in identity and faith is super important. And the more that you can nurture that and grow that and deepen that, I would say is time very well spent.
Yeah, I feel like security is a good word. It's like it actually gives you more freedom to do it because your identity is not resting in the balance if it doesn't go like you wanted. Yeah, that's a good word. Good state of the union, Connor. Yeah.
One more thing. Your work does not define who you are.
Say it again. Wow. Good.
Yeah. That is something, I mean, especially freshman and sophomore year, it has been so, I've been in so many critiques where people just pour themselves into a thing. And that's exactly what you're supposed to do. I mean, you put yourself in your projects, but your value is not tied to the things that you produce or the quality of thing that you produce. It's like people forget that this is school and that you're still learning,
right?
And that you don't need to be fully formed out the gate.
Yeah.
Like I have written some really terrible things as, like fairly recently too, but I've also written the play and I'm proud of the play. You have good things, you have bad things. None of it applies to your worth.
Yeah.
You know,
I appreciate you saying, because it's easy for us to say that about the not-so-good stuff, like my worst internet, but I also appreciate you saying it about the really good stuff. Like, I can be proud of a thing that I did and genuinely believe that it's good and that it represents me in some capacity, but, like, it isn't me. Like, I ought to still differentiate myself there.
Yeah, it's just we're all still learning, and so, I mean, yeah, this is the place to fail, fail a lot.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you need to learn these lessons one way or the other. And so, yeah, I would say just make stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that I mean, people ask, like, how do you find your voice? That was one thing during the film fest that a lot of students were asking these professionals. Like, how do you find your unique voice? And it's like, you just got to make stuff. You're going to sound like other people when you start. But the more you do it, the more you'll find you. Like in the good stuff and the bad stuff.
Yeah.
But you'll be you.
So. Yeah. Man, well said. All right. My last question as you wrap up, fun question. What are places in Savannah that like are your go-to places? Coffee shops, restaurants, places. What are you going to miss?
Ooh. Foxy Loxy is so amazing.
It's a gym.
Yes.
Especially the courtyard.
Oh my goodness. Like the courtyard. February, sunny day.
Yeah.
It's like high 50s, low 60s with a hot coffee and a lemon bar.
Man. Dreams really do come true.
Yeah. Like they say, heaven is a place on earth. It is Foxy Loxy. Like that place will be there in paradise.
In the new heavens, nothing will be
different. Nothing will be different. Like that's the sneak preview. Yeah, Foxy Loxy is definitely a great place. Coffee Roasters is great. I don't know, if you need a baked potato at 3 a.m. on a Saturday, Sputnik.
Y'all got a lot of Sputnik. I still haven't been. I know I'm missing out. I'll go with y'all one day before you graduate.
Yeah, let's go at 3 a.m. on a Saturday.
Sure.
Do Cookout. Go to Cookout late at night.
Yeah, we're overdue for a cookout run in RUF, aren't we?
Yeah, go yeah, you got to go like at 1 a.m. and the line's going to be way longer than you think it's going to be. And that's all part of the experience.
That's how you know you did it right.
Yeah. Everybody's going to have a very different order and it's all going to look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be a lot of confusion and a lot of anger when somebody steals your thing, but it's all part of the experience and it's all good and you should do it.
Well put. That feels like a good closing word. So Connor, thanks for joining us. RUF SCAD president. We're grateful for your service and leadership. So until next time, the RUF SCAD podcast.